All right. Good evening, everybody. My name is Dave Smith. Happy to be with you again. Tonight, we're going to talk about the Psila path factor, typically known as right action, and different perspectives on that. So it can be something that we can maybe embody more. But to just kind of back up to what I talked about last week and to give you some background into why I think this is such an important reframe of these teachings is that it's a really exciting time to be in the Dharma because there's lots of people doing academic perspectives and there's lots of just great stuff coming out. And one of the things that's emerged in the last maybe 5 or 10 years in the academic investigation into the Pali Canon is that there actually is pretty clear that at the time of the Buddha, there were two Dharma paths. One of them, which is emerging now, which is kind of the path for the people like us, who people who live in the world and who live of the world, basically people who are not monastics, which I suspect is all of you, certainly myself. And at the time of the Buddha, there were many, many people, hundreds, if not thousands of people who were doing the Dharma, they were practicing the Dharma, they were meeting with the Buddha, they were living a Dharma life, and they were artisans, they were craftspeople, they were farmers, they were butchers, they were potsmiths and blacksmiths. There were people who were like us. They lived in the world, they had family, they had houses, they had children, and they were dedicated to living the Dharma. Now, it wasn't soon after the Buddha died, probably relatively quickly after the Buddha died, that kind of went away. And then we have a 2,500-year-old history of Buddhism, which is really kind of what the Dharma turned into. The Dharma, when the Dharma became a monastic entity, it turned into this religion called Buddhism, which I love the religion of Buddhism. I'm a Buddhist fanatic. But I'm also a non-monastic Dharma practitioner, which puts me in a unique position where I really like to uncover this other path. And so that's kind of why I wanted to talk about these path factors and how can we, in secular contemporary society, embody things, teachings of finding our voice, of speech, of communication, of action, of the choices and how we live in the world. And one of the biggest topics, of course, is what do you do to survive? Mortgages, car payments, taxes, children, food, shelter, healthcare. The people in the monastery, they don't deal with these things. Do any of you have any stress in your life associated with any of those items I just mentioned? I'm sure that you do. Big topic. And so very relevant, I think. And I think that if we're going to really try to embrace this practice, we're really trying to embody a Dharma practice, it has to be relevant for the conditions that we find ourselves in. And we find ourselves in the modern world in very unique conditions. So that's kind of my thinking on this. I hope that makes sense. And the other thing to add to that is looking at the goal of Dharma practice. And so a lot of times they would use this kind of fancy word called soteriology. Soteriology is like an academic study of salvation. So all the world's religions, Buddhism, Christianity, Muslim, spiritual traditions, all fall under a soteriology. And that is, how do they explain human salvation or liberation or whatever you, however you think of that. What is the soteriological, every religion and spiritual practice has a soteriological goal. And of course, the monastic goal of Buddhism is to not to be reborn again as a human being, right? Is to meditate our way, liberation through wisdom, to understand things truly as they are, to uproot craving and greed and hatred and confusion to the point where we don't take birth again in a human body. Which I kind of find to be kind of negative. So the view of monastic Buddhism, the goal is to not be born again. So the assumption is it's better to not be born than it is to be born. And that somehow taking birth in a human body is some sort of like suffering experience that we all have to bear. And I don't like that so much, frankly. But if we look at this other Dharma path, the non-monastic path, the goal is not that. The goal is not to be one with the universe or to break the rounds of rebirth and karma and all that stuff, which I'll just politely put aside because I don't have any experience with that personally. Not much I can say other than I don't find it that attractive. Is to flourish. The soteriological goal of kind of non-monastic Buddhism is also very secular. It's how do we flourish? How do we live well? How do we do well in the world? And how you do that is you cultivate the Eightfold Path. It's pretty clear that that's what's being offered here. And so if we get out of this kind of mystical future life, past life, this kind of other idea, which I think is very distracting, and say, okay, like, how do I, this individual Dave Smith, living in the contemporary world that I live in with my conditions and my children and my concerns about the healthcare system and all the different things I have to deal with, how do I flourish in spite of that? So it's not a path that's trying to get to the end of dukkha. It's trying to live a life and embody a life that thrives and that flourishes in spite of dukkha. Which I'm very motivated by that. I like that. I'll sign up for that. I'm very interested in that. I suspect many of you are as well. And you've probably found that doing Dharma practice has been helpful, right? It helps us deal with our minds. It helps us deal with our relationships. It's useful for us to reflect and to contemplate and to change our relationship to our minds and change our relationships to the world. And you all been at this for a little while now, and I suspect you could all give me many examples of ways in which you have found it to be helpful. So when we look at the teachings of, so the word again is sama, is the word for right view, right intention, right action, right livelihood. Sama, which I just kind of say, we don't even really need that. Sama just means usually translated as right, which is actually kind of not a great translation, because now we're doing it right or we're doing it wrong, which isn't usually helpful. That's a bad measuring stick, I have found. But looking at speech or communication through our voice, how do we find our authentic voice? How do we learn to say what we mean without being mean to when we say it? How do we learn how to advocate for ourselves? How do we learn how to deal with the conflict of communication? And I talked about that a lot last week. I think hopefully you guys have that recorded. You could listen to it later if you missed it. And so this evening we're coming to right action, which sounds so rules. Here's the rules on how to behave, right action. So really, it actually, we could just drop the right and say action. And really what, and we'll do some practice on this. I'm not going to talk the whole time, but I wanted to give you a little bit of a setup, is that interestingly, if you look at the Pali for action, it's not action. The term is samakamanta. Kamanta means something more like work or what we do for our artisanship, what we do to find meaning, that it has an artistic element to it. Not necessarily livelihood now, but like from a therapeutic perspective, those of you who are in therapy, like they say, you gotta like do the work, right? I got the shirt on right now. You know, we have to do our Dharma work. And so interestingly, the word for action, probably many of you already know, is the word karma or kama in Pali. Usually karma, kama, action. It's not that mysterious of a term. Everybody knows this one. But when you look at the Pali, it's not samakama. It's not right action. It's samakamanta, which means how do we, to some degree, deal with ourselves? And so the question is, and I ask myself this question all the time, and this is probably unique to you, and we'll do a practice on this. What is your Dharma work? What are you working on in your practice? What have you been able to identify are your challenges? How are you taking those on? What has been working and how do you develop them? And it's really important, I think, for all of us to get a sense for what our work is. You know, I have a lot of self-judgment. I need to be more kind to myself. Okay, that's part of my work. You know, I for me, it's gratitude. I feel like I should have more gratitude than I have, actually. A lot of times when I look into my own heart or I look into my own experience, I said, I don't feel all that grateful necessarily, but I have lots of evidence to suggest that I should be. And then now I feel bad about that because I'm not doing that right. I'm not grateful enough. You know, so to think about the teachings, samakamanta, as getting a sense of your labor, you could use the word labor, your work, your endeavor, and to have some subjective sense of what you could or should be maybe working on. Some of us are great, and so we flourish in certain areas. So we'll do a practice on this here, sort of a metta vipassana practice is the way I like to teach this, because On one hand, we want to be able to recognize through mindfulness what our work might be. That's part of it. You know, I'm a little hard on myself, or, you know, my relationship to food isn't so great, or I have a awkward relationship to money, or whatever it is. I'm sure you notice that there's certain things in your life you kind of need to be working on. So we don't want to be in denial about those. We want to be in recognition of those. Then we want to see what is the relationship I have to this work. Do I feel up for the challenge? Do I beat myself up too hard? Do I let myself off the hook? This is for me, some of my big work is, COVID didn't help, is food. I love to eat. I love it. And I eat too much, and I don't always eat the best things. And sometimes I get myself too much off the hook. I'm like, it's okay. It's just have a cookie. It's, you deserve it. You know, it's like there's ways in which we can do that. And I don't really actually want to do that. So we can start to have a more broader, that's part of the way I'm defining it, is having more broader perspective on these path factors. So I'll walk you through this. I'll do some light instructions, and then we can talk about it some, and I'll unpack this teaching a little bit more for you this evening. So you can begin by finding an upright, comfortable way to sit. And I'll start and end the practice with the bell. So just taking a few minutes to pull away from the thinking and the dialogue and some of the ideas that might have arisen as a result of the introduction. See if you can just kind of let that be for now. And bring your awareness into your body, which is a huge part of our Dharma work, is to be embodied, to live inside the body, its sensory experience, the felt sense of the body as it arises in present time. So really feeling into that somatic heaviness, temperature, the sense of warmth or coolness, gravity, the range of comfort to discomfort that you might feel in the body. And also inviting a sense of ease or a sense of kindness coming into relationship with the body as it presents its age, its sexuality, gender, race. And trying to just bring a kind and accepting attitude towards the body, however you find it here now. And within this body structure, finding also breathing. Breathing your most fundamental relationship with the world, with each other. Breathing in, breathing out. And just here together this evening, developing this mindfulness of the breathing body, connecting and sustaining with that direct experience for the next few minutes. And as you get a sense for your ability to just be present, to see if you find the level of work or effort it takes to just simply be here in a way that feels present, accepting, open. And just the work of cultivation of present time awareness is always not always so simple. So to be easy on yourself as you endeavor in this way. Breathing in, breathing out. And much of the work in the practice is the relationship that we bring to ourselves. So beginning to bring an attitude of kindness, of metta, to your heart, to your mind, to your life. Of may I be at ease. May I treat myself with kindness and friendliness. and allowing myself to approach the practice here with an attitude of good enough. And then simply gathering the awareness back into the body and beginning to investigate or to get a sense of the attitude of the mind right now. Is there an attitude of mind that is wanting things to somehow be different? Or is there an attitude of mind that is resisting any part of the experience, wanting it to go away? And as best you can to convince the mind there's nowhere to go but here. This is largely our work. It's to tune in to the conditions that are present in its range of pleasure and pain and comfort and discomfort, joy, sorrow, whatever is in the mix for you this evening, to just open to that. And to see if you can just allow yourself to be well right now. to be good enough. Feeling into the body as it receives the in-breath. Let's go of the out-breath with no hesitation, no resistance. Seeing if we can also meet all of the other conditions of this moment in just the same way. Rising, passing, not trying to interfere or adjust or manipulate the experience. But to bring an attitude and sense of kindness to the ever-changing flow of events. To whatever degree of challenge this brings, difficulty. And then most importantly, a sense of kind, friendly metta towards ourselves as we endeavor in this way. Cultivating the mind, cultivating the heart. Doing this very important work here together this evening. And holding this space here together for the last 5 minutes of the practice. Opening to the full range of our experience and meeting things with a kind, friendly acceptance. Just a simple acceptance of things as they are. Doing the best you can and allowing that to be good enough. Thank you, everybody, for your practice this evening.